Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Ivory Coast death toll up to 21. Officials in Ivory Coast say a total of 21 people were killed in Sunday's attack by jihadist militants on a popular beach resort. The country's interior minister said Monday that the dead include 15 civilians, 3 soldiers, and 3 gunmen. 33 people were wounded. Earlier reports put the number of gunmen at 6. A spokesman for the interior ministry tells VOA's French to Africa service that officials have no information that other assailants are in hiding. UN envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, began a new round of peace talks today in Geneva, warning that there's only one alternative to the negotiations.
The alternative, some people call it Plan B, as you know. Well, as far as I know, the only Plan B available is return to war, and to even worse war than we had so far.
Speaking before a meeting with a delegation from the Syrian government, Mr. de Mistura said it's up to the people of Syria to decide their future, and the UN must help them. He said the plan is to hold indirect talks with each side for about 10 days, then after a recess, convene the next round of negotiations, beginning probably in early April. Turkey's military said its warplanes carried out 18 airstrikes Monday, targeting Kurdish militants in northern Iraq. The strikes against the Kurdistan Workers' Party, otherwise known as the PKK, came a day after a car bombing killed at least 37 people in Turkey's capital of Ankara. There's been no claim of responsibility, and Turkish officials said they expect to announce the results of the investigation sometime a little later on today. Turkish forces have been carrying out an offensive against the PKK since July, when President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared the fight would continue until every militant is defeated. This is VOA News. A UN special investigator says North Korea's leaders, including Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, must be held accountable for crimes against humanity committed against their people. The investigator has submitted his report to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, from where Lisa Schlein files this report for VOA.
Over the past 6 years, UN Special Investigator Marzuki Darusman has submitted a succession of hard-hitting reports to the Council detailing a wide range of horrendous human rights violations in North Korea. The human rights expert says North Korea has totally flaunted all requests made by the Human Rights Council to alleviate the suffering of its people. In addition, he blames North Korea for heightening tensions in Northeast Asia. He says the government's recent tests of a supposed hydrogen bomb and a long-range missile fly in the face of international prohibitions.
The denial of human rights to its citizens internally and this aggressive behavior externally are basically two sides of the same coin.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Darusman describes the abuse to which North Korea's people are subjected. Now, this includes incarceration of whole families in political prison camps. He's also received many reports of torture. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says she's not planning on changing her refugee policy. This despite heavy losses in recent state elections that showed conflicting opinions about her liberal approach to immigration. On Sunday, the Nationalist Alternative for Deutschland Party won representation in 3 state polls in what many saw as a protest vote against the chancellor's open-door policy on refugees. This is political scientist Gero Neubauer of the Berlin Free University.
The landscape in Germany changed because we have now a party at the right wing. In former times, we had only big conservative parties, but now we have a small right populist party, and this is new for Germany.
Chancellor Merkel has been under growing pressure to close Germany to migrants. Now, the United States is urging UN Security Council members to respond to Iran for its recent ballistic missile launch. Washington says the launches violate language of a UN resolution adopted in July, which calls upon Iran not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles. Calls upon Iran not to take. When asked if UN sanctions should be imposed against Iran, the Russian ambassador said no. He said that there's no legal violation of the Security Council resolution. A call is different from a ban. Legally, you cannot violate a call. That according to the Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin. For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yiswu Heeb. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The situation in Mozambique has reached crisis levels in terms of serious abuses that have led to thousands of Mozambicans fleeing from their villages, mainly in the Taita province, into Malawi to seek refuge there. Now over 10,000 Mozambicans are seeking shelter in Malawi in an overcrowded camp.
That's Dewa Mabinga, Senior Southern Africa Researcher for Human Rights Watch. We'll have full details on this story coming up.
Also, German Chancellor Angela Merkel says her government will not change its refugee policy despite election setbacks over the weekend, and the EU suspends direct financial support to Burundi's government.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, in Ivory Coast, Sunday's deadly attack on beachgoers outside the commercial capital, Abidjan, was the country's first real brush with terrorism. The attack killed 15 civilians and left more than 20 wounded. The government says three soldiers were also killed, as well as three attackers. Emily Yeob reports from the streets of Abidjan.
There is the usual hustle and bustle on the street of Abidjan Monday, but the day is far from normal. Abidjan resident Yuan Gei says psychosis has set in and is big. He says, we are scared that maybe they could come to Abidjan. One local headline calls it a bloodbath. Another simply reads, we are all Grambassam. The seaside town is just 50 kilometers outside Abidjan. Militant sect Hakim claimed the attack in a short message sent to a local Sahelian news site. For over a decade, Hakim has primarily operated for the north in the Sahara Desert. But West Africa has been on alert following recent attacks on upscale hotels in Bamako and Ouagadougou. The beach resorts of Grambassam are a popular relaxation spot for both expatriates and locals. Abidjan resident Hugues Kwame says this group is not just targeting Westerners anymore, it's everybody. We are all concerned, he says. Of the 14 civilians killed, so far only two are confirmed to have been non-Ivorian. For many in Abidjan, the attack came as a shock, but not exactly a surprise. Local resident Adama Kone says it is not surprising given the political and economic importance of Ivory Coast in the region. He says we knew it was going to eventually happen, we just didn't know where or when. Street trader Roland Guina says more security is the answer.
Oui, ça a été renforcé, mais on veut qu'on renforce encore la sécurité plus.
Yes, he says, the state has already increased security, but we need more, so it never happens again. Despite the fear, local resident Stéphane Tano says he will not change his lifestyle. He says, I'm not going to stop going to places where there are lots of people because we must live with this risk every day. Emily Yob from VOA News in Abidjan.
Thank you, Emily. The United States says it condemns in the strongest terms the attacks in Ivory Coast. The U.S. says it sends its condolences to the families and loved ones killed in what it calls a heinous attack. And it says its thoughts and prayers are with those who were injured. Also, Italian Premier Matteo Renzi says that terrorists will not intimidate the world. Mr. Renzi says that no matter how bloody their hate is, they will not succeed in making the world bow down. He says the international community's response will be firm, unanimous, and resolute. In addition, the UN Security Council condemned the attack, saying that terrorism in all its forms and manifestations constitutes one of the most serious threats to international peace and security.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel says her government will not change its refugee policy despite election setbacks over the weekend. The right-wing AfD party defeated Mrs. Merkel's Christian Democratic Union party in two out of three state elections. Her spokesman says Germany will continue a strategy of strengthening its borders and working with Turkey to reduce refugee flows. At the same time, he says Germany will try to make it easier for migrants and refugees to integrate into German society. However, Ms. Merkel did say today that the recent closing of the Balkans route to migrants benefits her country. The move reduces the number of people coming to Germany. In related news, at the Greek-Macedonian border, hundreds of migrants and refugees have left the overcrowded camp at Idomene. They are trying to find an alternate route from Greece to Germany now that Balkan countries have closed their borders to them.
President Obama recently defended his decision not to use force against Syrian President Assad, but critics have described the administration's policy in Syria as a failure. The chairman of the U.S. Senate Armed Forces Committee said the civil war in Syria and the flow of refugees into Europe represent one of the most serious crises the West has faced since the end of World War II. VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy has details.
President Barack Obama said he is proud of his 2013 decision not to strike Mr. Assad's government to punish him for using chemical weapons against Syrians, calling it the right decision to make. In an interview with The Atlantic magazine, Mr. Obama described the sectarian conflicts in the region as a competition between Iran and close U.S. partner Saudi Arabia. He urged both to find an effective way to share the neighborhood. Republican critics argue that President Obama has lost his credibility in the Middle East. They say he failed to take action despite threatening that use of chemical weapons would cross a red line and trigger tough U.S. response. Senator John McCain described Europe's migrant crisis as a direct result of what he perceived as the failure of the U.S. policy in the Middle East.
The United States' failure in Syria and Iraq has had a significant impact on the cause of the flow of refugees. If the United States had gotten rid of Bashar Assad and kept Iraq under control, we wouldn't be experiencing the refugee crisis that we are today.
Senator McCain told VOA that the United States should have an obligation to try to help Europe out as much as possible. The Republican senator agreed with a testimony by NATO Supreme Military Commander General Philip Breedlove that Russia and the Assad government were deliberately weaponizing migration to break up the entire European Union. Senator McCain expressed his concern about ISIS leaders using young Muslims in the West to launch terrorist attacks that would eventually target the United States.
Mr. Baghdadi already has sent some of them back in order to commit acts of terror. It is a significant threat. And that's why our Director of National Security, General Clapper, testified before our committee that there would most likely be further attacks on the United States of America by ISIS.
Senator McCain says the failure of the U.S. to lead has allowed Russia to gain a position of influence in the Middle East for the first time since 1973. That's the year when the late Egyptian President Anwar Sadat threw the Russians out of Egypt. McCain concluded that because Russian influence and the backing of Iran and Hezbollah, it is very unlikely that Syrian President Assad will leave any time soon. Mohammed Elshenawy, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Mohammed. In Geneva today, talks began to end a serious five-year-old civil war, but little was accomplished. The French news agency reports the opposing sides could not agree on the agenda. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry calls the peace talks a moment of truth where everyone must be responsible.
The European Union has suspended direct financial support to Burundi's government, but says it will continue to offer humanitarian assistance to civilians. The EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy says the situation in Burundi remains of serious concern. Federica Mogherini says, however, there have been some recent glimpses of hope. She adds the Burundi government must take what she calls concrete measures for aid to resume. This includes participating in the inter-Burundian dialogue being mediated by the East Africa community. Over 400 people have been killed in violence that erupted nearly 1 year ago when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. About 240,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries.
Human Rights Watch HRW says it welcomes the announcement that Mozambique will further investigate the human rights violations that are said to be taking place against families in the central province of Tete. Government soldiers told HRW that government soldiers have been committing the abuses in attempts to disarm the Renamo militia. As a result, an estimated 10,000 people have fled the country and are in makeshift camps in Malawi. Dewa Mavhinga is a senior Southern Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me about the latest developments as well as the dire situation of the refugees in Malawi.
The situation in Mozambique has reached crisis levels in terms of serious abuses that have led to thousands of Mozambicans fleeing from their villages, mainly in the Tete province, into Malawi to seek refuge there. Now over 10,000 Mozambicans are seeking shelter in Malawi in an overcrowded camp because they are fleeing fighting between Mozambique's government forces and the armed wing of the opposition RENAMO in Mozambique.
What people are saying is that these human rights abuses are being done by the soldiers and other people.
Yes, we have been to Malawi to talk to the people fleeing from Mozambique, and they have told Human Rights Watch that they are running away from abuses by the army, which included killings of family members, summary executions, the burning down of houses, property, and grain storage facilities, as well as maize fields. A number of them said they had fled with just the clothes on their bodies, and a number had separated from their families and were too afraid to go back to Mozambique because of what they had witnessed at the hands of the Mozambican government soldiers. And many said that the primary driver of these abuses was that the soldiers would be looking for RENAMO militia and would demand information and beat up people to for them to disclose allegedly the whereabouts of RENAMO militia. But these people are just villagers who have no idea, therefore unable to continue to stay in their villages for fear of these attacks from government soldiers.
The Mozambican government has announced that they are looking into these human rights violations. Have you received any further word from them?
Not as yet. Human Rights Watch welcomes such investigations, and we hope that these would be independent investigations by an impartial body, because the government of Mozambique is accused through its army of perpetrating some of these abuses. It would be difficult for them to investigate themselves. So we hope that the government will set up an independent mechanism to look into these abuses.
Those people that have fled into Malawi, what state are they in? What is their condition?
Well, in Malawi, it is a humanitarian crisis that is unfolding because they are in extremely overcrowded conditions in Malawi's Mwanza district in the south of the country, where they are at a makeshift camp in Kapisa village, which is just next to the border with Mozambique. So they remain vulnerable from further attacks because they are very close to Mozambique, and groups that are supposed to give humanitarian assistance to these people are unable to do that effectively because of the camp's proximity to the border, and also because the government of Malawi has not yet formally set up an official refugee camp to give status to these people. So they are deemed to be asylum seekers. The focus, it appears, while we were on the ground, was not on facilitating their safety in Malawi, but on facilitating repatriation to Mozambique. And this is where, as Human Rights Watch, we raise concern that until conditions in Mozambique are conducive for safe return, it would be inappropriate and premature for the government of Malawi and Mozambique to focus on returning these people back to Mozambique.
Dewa Mavhinga is a senior Southern Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The ongoing fall in oil prices apparently has come to an end. The International Energy Agency has announced that prices may have bottomed out after a long, steady decline that meant lower gas prices for consumers, but economic woes for oil producers. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The IEA says the bottoming out of oil prices is due in part to declines in production by non-OPEC countries and an increase in Iranian production. The U.S. and other nations expect to see output fall by 750,000 barrels per day this year. That's compared to earlier estimates of 600,000 barrels a day. In the U.S. alone, oil output is expected to fall this year by 530,000 barrels a day. Among those following developments is Anthony Starkey, manager of energy analysis at Platts Bentek. He says prices had fallen so low in some cases that oil producers had trouble paying transportation costs.
Just in general, there's a lot of logistics involved in getting the crude collected from wherever it's being produced and getting it transported to the demand centers, which is the refineries, which are going to turn that crude into, you know, the things that we use, the fuels that we use. And those transportation costs have to be kind of factored in to what the person producing oil is going to get.
He says some grades of crude were actually trading below $10 a barrel.
So it just wasn't really sustainable from that standpoint. Certainly there wasn't going to be any further investment in exploring and drilling new wells at those price levels. And so that bottoming process, as those futures prices kind of dipped into that upper $20, low $30 range, it really is kind of like a fundamental floor for oil prices.
Any increase in the price of oil is good news for producers, but some countries base their budgets on expected revenues. So when prices were over $100 a barrel, things were great. Not so when they fell under half that.
We're still at very suppressed oil prices relative to where they've been over the past few years. So I guess it's all really relative. While producers would be the ones somewhat benefiting from a higher oil price, they're still, you know, struggling considerably versus what they were receiving just 2 years ago.
Starkey says the collapse in oil prices in recent years hurt some economies, like Russia, for example.
You know, the Russian ruble fell nearly 50%, just as oil prices were also falling 50%. So in Russian currency terms, you know, their oil revenues didn't really fall all that much. Now, the flip side of that is with the much weaker currency, you know, your imports costs have gone higher. There's other impacts to your economy. So that's the negative side of it. You know, as oil prices move higher, it's going to be a net benefit for these guys. You know, take Russia, for example, you know, producing roughly 10 million barrels of oil per day. Every dollar increase in oil price means an extra $10 million a day, theoretically, that they're going to see.
So how high can the price of a barrel of crude go for producers to make a decent profit without gouging drivers at the pump?
In terms of the consumer impact, certainly lower oil prices has been beneficial to us. Now, what kind of equilibrium price is where everyone's kind of happy, it's really hard to say. I mean, obviously, consumers would like it to stay at 30 to 40, and producers would like it to stay at 90 to 100. So, you know, kind of cutting it down the middle, so to speak, and drawing kind of an equilibrium there between the two sides, you know, probably something in the $60 to $70 range long term is probably, you know, a happy medium for both people.
Here in the U.S., gasoline prices usually rise in the summertime. The fuel specifications become more stringent because of the higher temperatures and evaporation and pollution concerns. It's more expensive to make, too, because it's often blended with ethanol. The Platts Bentek manager expects prices to be around the $2 a gallon range. He thinks the next 2 years may be tough for the U.S. oil industry, but expects it to rebound in 2018. Yet, with greater acceptance of global warming, more energy companies are investing in alternative and renewable energy research. However, he says it's hard to predict how fast that sector will grow. Starkey says the return of Iranian oil to the market following the lifting of international sanctions has not had a major impact yet.
It really hasn't, and I think it has more to do with the fact that there's been some unexpected disruptions to supply elsewhere that have helped kind of offset some of that returning Iranian oil. The two biggest ones are Iraq and Nigeria. Two pipelines in both those countries have been sabotaged over the past month and stopped flow on those pipelines, which effectively stopped the oil from being produced and exported. returning Iranian production has largely kind of filled some of that gap of that missing production.
He says the real test for the market will be when those pipelines are repaired and more Iraqi and Nigerian oil is exported. The problems in Nigeria, Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates caused OPEC production to fall by 90,000 barrels a day in February. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In the eastern DRC, Virunga National Park authorities say two park rangers were killed in attacks over the weekend, and a third ranger is missing. They say about 120 members of the Mai Mai militia attacked four ranger positions on Lake Edward beginning early Saturday morning. The two rangers were captured and then executed by the militia. Authorities say there appears to be a new coalition of Mai Mai rebels that was formed to attack park rangers. About 150 rangers have been killed in Virunga over the last 10 years. Park rangers and the Congolese army launched a counteroffensive to retake the positions. One rebel was killed and one arrested.
Malawi burned nearly 800 elephant tusks today in a show of force against the illegal wildlife trade. Customs officials seized the ivory back in 2013 when it was smuggled into Malawi from Tanzania. Lamek Masina reports from a wildlife sanctuary in Mzuzu.
Park rangers set fire to the 2.6 ton mound of ivory at Mzuzu Sanctuary in northern Malawi. The ivory stockpile was worth an estimated $3 million US. Brighton Kunchedwa is Malawi's director of parks and wildlife.
In fact, what we're saying is the smuggled ivory has no value because there's a law that bars international trade. So otherwise, what we're saying is stop the trafficking of wildlife products, particularly ivory.
The ivory was seized in 2013. But the High Court in Nzuzu only gave officials the go-ahead to ban it this month. Tanzania had initially blocked the banning, saying it needed some of the ivory as evidence for court proceedings there. Two Malawian siblings were arrested in conjunction with this load of ivory. They were fined $5,500 for trafficking. This is the first time Malawi has banned seized ivory. The banning comes amid growing sense of urgency on the continent over the continued illegal slaughter of elephants. Malawi's Department of Wildlife says Malawi has lost half of its elephant population since 1980, mainly to poaching. The country has also become a common crossroads for ivory traffickers. Kunchedwa says government is addressing that.
This was coming from Tanzania because our legislation is very weak. But as we speak, we are reviewing the legislation to have it give out stiffer penalties.
The international commercial trade in ivory was banned in 1989, but experts say elephant poaching has only intensified to meet an ever-growing demand for ivory in Asia. The African Wildlife Foundation says an estimated 35,000 elephants were killed in Africa last year. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Nzuzu, Malawi.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
And we're delivering more sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Starting March 21st, the Sunny Side of Sports is expanding to half an hour. Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.
African Music Mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Whoa! Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Ivory Coast, yesterday's deadly attack outside the commercial capital Abidjan was the country's first real brush with terrorism. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says her government will not change its refugee policy despite election setbacks over the weekend. And the EU suspends direct financial support to Burundi's government. Coming up, we'll have music from Senegal, and in our feature report, a global gathering of scientists, government representatives, and innovators in Dakar. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Welcome back, Sunny.
Thanks, Kim. Great to be back behind the VOA microphone.
Yes, good to have you back. And I understand you're beginning with Olympic news.
Kim, the countdown continues for the Rio Olympics in Brazil. Remember, VOA Olympic fans, the opening ceremony for the multi-sports extravaganza will be August 5th at the Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. Joining us now from Rio with an update on the city's Olympic preparations is our friend Luis Piazzet. Sporty Olympic greetings, Luis. What's the word of the day?
Sport Olympic greetings, Sonny. Challenge is the word of the day. For the preparations of the Olympics in Rio, challenges are still the same as when the city won the privilege to hold the big event. Constructions to finish, and typical Brazilian problems to solve, from mobility to security, from pollution and sanitation to health, like the lack of hospitals and the outbreak of a Zika endemic threat into a true epidemic. Since it sprouted in Brazil exactly a year ago, officials and scientists simply don't know yet what to prioritize. To kill the transmitter mosquito? To seek a vaccine? Or to educate people on how to avoid contracting the virus. Victims are growing every day, amounting over thousands in Brazil. Sequels will last generations to come, including babies with small brains. A not-so-new issue is the electricity, the extra power needed to run the giant structure for the games, the media center and the facilities of competition venues, housing and public transportation. A few days ago, the Senate approved a bill to subsidize suppliers of energy, but the organizers still discuss implementing non-environment-friendly generators or alternative sustainable sources of energy. On another track, the IOC, International Olympic Committee, announced that a court of arbitration of sports will handle the anti-doping procedures and compliance to rules. Not accidentally, more than 60 athletes, including Olympic medalists and world champions, have tested positive this year for meldonium, the prohibited performance-enhancing drug the Russian top-seed tennis Maria Sharapova admitted to using. Sharapova will miss the Olympics because of that. The Brazilian fastest runner Ana Cláudia Lemos Silva, a Navy surgeon, was also caught positive and lost her sponsorship from the government. In the meantime, the clock's ticking for Rio's IOC-accredited drug testing laboratory. It has until March 18th to meet guidelines from WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. We contacted Professor Francisco Radler, director of the Brazilian Doping Control Laboratory, located at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. Professor Francisco is confident the lab will meet WADA's guidelines on time. The lab works close to the Brazilian Anti-Doping Control Authority, an office of the Sport Ministry. We also spoke with Mr. Marco Aurelio, the man in charge of the Brazilian Anti-Doping Control Authority, and he added a piece to the puzzle. WADA demands a sole court of arbitration in Brazil, while FIFA argues its soccer-profitable franchise has its own way of solving doping issues. WADA's disagreement with FIFA on this subject has been going on since almost a decade. It's only 1 week to go, but according to Mr. Marco Aurelio, Brazil will have in place a law to meet WADA's guideline, with or without FIFA agreement, although the team of technicians and staff will not be ready until the eve of the Olympics. So much for challenge. It seems that all will be done by the eve of the opening ceremony. I am Luis Piazet for the Sony Side of Sports.
You crave more sports news? We're here to fulfill your wishes on VOA Africa. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
And this programming note, beginning Monday, March 21st, the Sunny Side of Sports will expand to 30 minutes daily. So be sure to tune in at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the newly expanded 30 minutes Sunny Side of Sports beginning March 21st. Turning to African athletics, Kenya dominated the Africa Cross Country Championships in Cameroon over the weekend. Picking up the story, here's the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
A new-look Kenyan team retained all individual and team titles at the Africa Cross Country Championships in Yaounde, Cameroon on Saturday. James Rungaru clocked 26 minutes and 34 seconds to edge Ugandan Philip Kipyeko by a second to win the senior men's 10 kilometers. Kenyan Charles Mnarea placed third. Uganda placed second ahead of Ethiopia in the team standings. Meanwhile, All Africa Games 10,000 meter champion Alice Aprot clocked 29 minutes and 52 seconds to lead Sheila Chepkurui and Beatrice Mutai in a 1-2-3 Kenyan sweep in the women's 10 kilometers. Ethiopia placed second and South Africa placed third in team prizes. Staying in Yaounde, Isaac Kipsang and Ronald Kiprotich secured a 1-2 Kenyan triumph in the junior men's 8 kilometers, with Eritrean Aaron Kifle claiming the bronze medal. Ethiopia are runners-up ahead of South Africa in the team standings. Earlier on, Mariam Cherop, Gloria Kite and Winifred Mbithi clinched a 1-2-3 Kenyan dominance in the junior women's 6 kilometers. Ethiopia were second in the team honors, while Morocco were placed third. In Italy, Morocco held Africa's flag high at the World University Cross Country Championships in Cassino, some 140 kilometers southeast of the Italian capital Rome, on Saturday. Hicham Amgar, Rida Jafar, Youssef Ben Haji, and Mohamed Agouram secured a 1-2-3-4 Moroccan triumph in the men's race. Morocco comfortably won the team event, while Algeria placed fifth among 12 teams. In contrast, Algeria's Siham Ait Athaman was 19th and the best placed African in the women's race. Morocco placed 6th and Algeria 7th among 9 teams. Turning to football, Nigeria, Ghana and Cameroon triumphed in the opening leg of the second round of the Africa FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup qualifiers on Saturday. Rashidat Ajibade scored 4 goals and Yetunde Fajobi added 2 more in the first half to secure Nigeria's emphatic 6-0 triumph over their visiting South African peers in Abuja. Elsewhere, Ghana upstaged their hosts Morocco 4-0 in Marrakech as Cameroon used home advantage to edge Egypt 2-1 in Yaounde. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. For Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Elsewhere in African athletics, Kenya's Solomon Kirwa Yego ran the fastest half marathon time in the world this year Sunday when he clocked 58 minutes and 44 seconds in Rome, Italy. Yego won the 42nd annual Rome Ostia Half Marathon, and his time was also a course record. Overall, the Kenyans took the top four places in the Roman race, with Leonard Langat, Remy Limo, and Peter Quemoy finishing second, third, and fourth, respectively.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Let's stand up now for Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be with you.
What's trending in the sports world on this Monday?
Well, we heard a little bit ago a story about the Olympics, and there's something interesting I found on social media. The South by Southwest Digital Technology Conference here in the U.S., probably the biggest such conference in the country. They have a number of panels that are actually about the Rio Olympics, and people were live tweeting those using hashtag Rio16SXSW, which stands for South by Southwest. But they had people from NBC News and NBC Sports. NBC is the network that airs the Olympics here in the U.S., talking about how they're integrating social media and digital technology into their coverage.
Okay.
So very interesting that social media, even, you know, a decade ago or less was kind of, oh, if people did it, it was, you know, great. Or if athletes did it, it was great. But now it's actually part of the plan. And it's something they actually have teams of people that are focusing on social media, how they're going to use that. The head of NBC Sports saying they want to capture a lot of these moments and kind of the feel of the Olympics, taking people into the athletes' village, into the events, and taking them into what the athletes are experiencing and seeing. So,
and
really interesting.
We touched on it earlier, but I think we're seeing more and more of these Rio-bound athletes making their presence felt on social media.
Absolutely. You see these athletes as they're qualifying, as they're training, and now they're preparing to go down to Rio. And you see NBC Sports as well, they're ramping up on things like Instagram. They're posting a lot more pictures, countdowns up until the day of the Olympics starting, best of, you know, moments in history. So you're seeing a lot of that ramping up, a lot of excitement that they're generating through social media for the upcoming Olympics.
Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. I received a Facebook message from Don Eletu. I think Don is writing from Nigeria, but I'm not quite sure about that. Anyways, Don writes, "Hi, Sonny, you are really welcome back. I did miss your ever scintillating sports presentation." Don adds that he was hoping I would give him a birthday shout out last week on his birthday, March 8th. Well, Don, how about a belated birthday shout out? Sending belated birthday greetings to Don Eletu, one of our loyal Sunny Side of Sports listeners. Andrew, what else is trending in sports?
Well, the big news here in the U.S. is the NCAA basketball tournament. This is the college tournament where you have 68 teams vying to be the champion in college basketball. But, of course, everyone's focused on the brackets. Everybody
right.
fills out a, you know, it's a bracket trying to winnow down the field and trying to pick who's going to win. And CBS News airs the NCAA tournament, and they actually had a huge 2-hour, you know, they were going to reveal the different teams, and somebody leaked the bracket on social media ahead of time, so everybody already knew who the teams were before they could make their big announcement.
So that kind of
it took
killed the drama.
A lot of the air out of that excitement. There was people joking on social media saying these kids, because what they do is they have cameras that show the different teams, and they shoot the teams as they receive this announcement, so you see them jumping up in the air and cheering. They said those kids were doing a really great job trying to pretend that they, you know, already didn't know that they were going to be in the tournament because they already saw the bracket.
You mentioned 68 teams. Who are the top seeds, Andrew?
So the top seeds are the Oregon Ducks, the Virginia Cavaliers, the North Carolina Tar Heels, and the Kansas Jayhawks, which is my favorite team. They are the overall number one. And they also have Cheick Diallo on the team, who's just a freshman there. He's from Mali.
Okay.
But he's been a great player on that team, has helped them, and he's got hopefully some great years to come. So a lot of excitement about the NCAA tournament. I'm excited as a Kansas fan. I'm hoping that they go very far. They're actually picked to be the winner, so I'm hoping that holds true.
Yeah, you mentioned the Malian player, Andrew. In fact, Vanderbilt a few years ago had a Nigerian player on their squad, Festus Ezeli, and some of these players do go up a level to the professional level. Ezeli now with the Golden State Warriors in the NBA. Pretty good club to be on as a professional.
Absolutely. And that's maybe that's something we'll talk about tomorrow, is the Golden State, because that's a whole social media conversation right there about how well they're doing.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
Thank you.
And we'll see you on Tuesday.
Excellent.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a global gathering of scientists, government representatives, and innovators in Senegal. But first, some music. Here is Viviane Ndour from Senegal with Samanene. Vivian Ndoro from Senegal with Samanene.
The next Einstein will come from Africa. Well, that is the premise of a global gathering of scientists, government representatives, and innovators who met in Senegal earlier this month. Alpha Diallo has more from Dakar.
The organizers of the next Einstein Forum say sub-Saharan Africa contributes just 1% of the world's scientific research output. That is not for lack of ingenuity, but rather lack of opportunity. Senegalese President Macky Sall and his Rwandan counterpart Paul Kagame opened the forum in Dakar with pledges to invest more in scientific education and research. In recent years, both countries have opened specialized institutions for science, math, and technology. Flavia Segel is UNESCO's Undersecretary General for the Natural Sciences. She says brain drain is a problem.
Well, I think if Africa and African countries like Senegal or Rwanda explained today can actually bring a future to young people, opportunities for good professional careers, I would say these young people either would not leave or they will come back again to be reunited with their families and friends in their home countries.
Scientists who remain in Africa encounter daily challenges. Ghanaian researcher Victor Osei is participating in the forum.
If you're a scientist doing a science project, you obviously need certain things to be available, the least of which probably is something like electricity. I can't imagine a science research project that has to be stopped because there's no good supply of electricity, for instance. So these are all things that when we talk about the enabling environment, we need to think about.
Organizers of the forum say today the continent loses out on about $4 billion each year when Africans go abroad for jobs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But the managing director of the next Einstein Forum, Arun Sharma, says Africa is poised for a scientific boom.
I think there's also a huge amount of political will which is now coming up, and it's clear that the politicians, not all the politicians, but many of the decision makers, are recognizing the necessity for science and technology to be a driver for Africa.
Sharma says the goal of this week's forum is to showcase the work of young African scientists and help connect them with opportunities for education and funding. Alpha Diallo for VOA News, Dakar.
And
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The periodic warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, known as El Niño, causes weather and short-term climate changes in other parts of the globe. The El Niño of 2015-2016 is the strongest on record, and nowhere have been extreme weather effects associated with El Niño been more intensely felt than in Ethiopia. Last summer's Kiremt, or main rainy season, has been weak, and the short spring bell grains are delayed. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the resulting drought, the worst Ethiopia has experienced in five decades, has led to successive crop failures and widespread livestock deaths, tripling the humanitarian needs. Some 10.2 million Ethiopians are now chronically hungry, while some 7.5 million farmers and herders need immediate agricultural support to produce both grains and livestock in the coming season. Since October 2014, the United States has provided over $500 million in aid to Ethiopia and another $4 million worth of seeds, a critical need for farmers, given that the planting season will begin soon. But this year, we are taking an extra step, one we feel is necessary if we are to prevent this crisis from growing much, much worse. Instead of waiting for the situation to develop into a full-blown emergency, we are sending in a disaster assistance response team, a group of experts that will evaluate the situation on the ground, pinpoint gaps in the aid plan, and accelerate and expand the emergency response, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We are moving earlier in this case because we have found that there is real agreement between donors, NGOs, the government, and UN agencies that if we move very, very quickly, we can avert the worst impacts of this drought. We hope that by taking this step, we will lead the rest of the international community, said Administrator Smith. If we move now, if other donors move with us, we think we can do two things: avert the worst impacts and protect some of the development gains that the country has made over many years, she said. We are challenging the world not just to respond to human suffering, but to respond quickly enough to prevent something even worse.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk. Lost love. Do you still remember your first love? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing lost love. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
You asked for it,
and we're delivering more sports.
I love Sunnyside Sports.
Starting March 21st, the Sunnyside of Sports is expanding to half an hour. Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.